Okay, so we got a great inventory here. So we go to this, and what was interesting when he in 1964 when he first got the center, was given to him in 63, he went right to the top and turned the computer into an art form. He proposed that they take the computer and measure the media diets of whole countries and develop the sensory profile of the countries and then figure out what media to cancel or supplement that matches the sensory profile of the global operation. You know, and he said, look, we manage money in a programmed way. Banking in the 60s, you would put money here, take it away. You basically a conspiratorial, let the bankers run the money system environment. And so he doesn't get mad about that. He says, just as we have programmed our economic environment, we can program the larger media environments. So he advocated the rigorous tyrannical control of the Federal Reserve and how the chairman ran the interest rates and all that as a model for a bigger project. Let's do it to the whole global theater environment. And he said, if you can accept money being programmed like that, then why can't you accept the media environments? So there are several letters here where he proposes this to various people. They have a press conference in May 1964 with the articles on it show a big, huge, fancy building. And that's what he was envisioning, this huge, advanced, what would be an example, World Trade Center kind of building. And it never got past a little coach house that he had, that he was in. So people used to come to the Center for Culture Technology on the University of Toronto campus in the Catholic University section called St. Michael's College, and they'd enter the coach house, and then they'd start looking around, looking for the stairs to the main big building. And they'd eventually have to deal with the fact that, no, this is it. There's no stairway to the big building. There's no big building. Because it was such a grandiose center. Center for Culture and Technology. That's putting yourself right at the center of the unfolding of reality. We're for culture and technology, like for everything. The center for everything. Mm-hmm. big terms. So people were surprised at what actually McLuhan, the tiny operation he had going when they got there. So we bring in, I've got four notes, four letters on this. So the first one begins, it says, research project for sensory preferences of entire populations. Research project for sensory preferences of entire populations. Talk about thinking big. Then he says, the purpose of the research. So this is a proposal. So the title is Research Project for Sensory Preferences of Entire Populations, Purpose, and then subtitle Purpose of the Research. So the first part says, the purpose, to study the effects of computer technology on the patterns of individual perception, private sensory order, and learning process. So that's a general statement. Then he has a colon. Then he says, to study the effects of sensory extension created by TV, radio, telephone, travel, etc., on the patterns of individual perception, private sensory order, and learning process. Then he says, example, a speed-up in data processing alters the order of learning and of perception, both in the individual and in the community. Management decision-making has become a chronic crisis situation as a result of speed-up of information available to the decision-makers. They are compelled to seek patterns rather than fragmented facts. Home, school, and commerce are all affected. If Peter F. Drucker, and he was King Management Consultant at that point, he was just starting to become, he's the guy who brought the Nazi Fritz Kramer over to run the Pentagon. So Drucker, highly suspicious with his European oligarchy background. Anyway, if Peter F. Drucker is correct in saying that 90% of the problems are caused by 10% of the motivating forces then IBM is in the 10%. He also claims that this 10% area is always ignored, and it is the area of opportunity. Okay, so that's the first statement. Any questions about that? Is your mind big enough to realize the daunting goal 50 years ago of his project?
Pretty daunting.
Yeah. Can you imagine offering to program everybody's media diet? Most people are going to object. Matter of fact, whenever I mentioned to a normal citizen, they'd always go, that's fascism. That's what that was their immediate image. Well, that's goddamn fascism. Who was a fascist? That's how they heard it. They didn't know they were already being programmed that way amateurishly.
You're right. Yeah.
With no perception of what the effects were doing on older media and newer media. He's turning the global theater and the media environments into an art form, an art form defined as something that is creating a pattern of beauty or symmetry that is important to understand. So he said,
yeah, Bob,
painting.
Just like we discussed Ted Kaczynski's conditioning at Harvard.
Yeah, that was crude. Those guys, the literate psychologists, as shown in the TV series, were trying to program one guy or a few people. And they thought that would be a breakthrough. And meanwhile, the satellite environment had come. They were heading for the moon. And these guys are still thinking in 19th century minuscule landscapes.
Right.
But the thing here is that the arts were music, ballet, dance, sculpture, painting, basket weaving, whatever you put in museums or in entertainment centers. So McLuhan says, that's not art. That doesn't affect people the way art did 900, 200 years ago. The art form are the media landscapes, and that's your palette. You paint with the different media environments. With the computer gathering the data of how the reactions are piling up, which is like Bill Binney, the guy at National Security Agency. They were doing it on a puny level compared to McLuhan, but they were on a bigger level to the normal awareness. They were trying to, you know, modulate
they
control
wars. They were looking
wars.
For patterns. They were looking for patterns.
So he was trying to make something beautiful by programming the environment. Okay.
Right.
He was trying to make art.
And I once, and when I talked to him about it, through the evergreens, through talking to his ghost, he said, I said, were you serious? He says, yes, but the logistics of it would have been very difficult to, act out. So it mainly was he presented this idea. It's like ideas art form. He presented this, we've got to look and think big. Think about the environments we're in. How would you orchestrate them to create a pattern of harmony? So he had that was his solution. If you're a critic of society, you got to have a solution. So he had this mind-blowing solution, which was first presented in Playboy magazine in March 69 was the first time the public really heard this. And he would say things like, you got a lot of civil war going on in Venezuela because there's too much radio, so you turn off the radio and you just have newspapers be the environment in Venezuela. So he's talking at massive levels. He was imitating the Illuminati who were sort of running banking that way. He created a bigger scenario than the Illuminati ideas. What?
So he felt that the newspaper, reintroducing the newspaper, would harmonize that culture?
The radio effect. Yeah, because they were an oral culture in Venezuela, radio inflamed because there's a lot of oral content and inflamed the tribal passions. So you bring in visual medium, a flat newspaper page, make everybody read that. That'll calm them down. They can't be screaming at each other all the time as you can with radio shows.
Yeah, so that's very intense. That's
big alchemical hypnotherapy.
It is big. It is exactly big alchemical hypnotherapy.
Right.
Really big.
Yeah.
Cool.
Is.
Well, I mean, and can you analyze every culture accurately enough to know the exact medium that will produce the desired effect?
Well, he proposed
some cultures.
You could.
He does think that.
Yeah, that in contrast, he had figured it out. He figured out the laws of media. What'd you say, Gene?
Russia. If you compare Russia to the United States in regard to the implementation of technology, Russia's an example of what is it? Are they still literate, or what are they stuck in that they didn't advance in the way that the United
States
did?
Well, they, because he said radio in the 20s and 30s, see, they were very crash programming industry right after World War One. They had the revolution in 1917. Henry Ford got a contract to build car plants. They're into cars. So they start doing all these car things right away. And it was inspiring the artists, the constructivists of the day. They were called the constructivist movement. And everybody was joining in communally making industry, hardware. But then radio came along, and Bakunin said the oral culture of Russia, being mainly a not-so-industrialized, visually biased culture, they suddenly had their medieval Russian Empire fantasies come back, strongly retrieved. And so everybody went medieval. And Stalin took over and got rid of the industrious Lenin. So Stalin's image resonated with the retrieving of medieval sensibility, an unforeseen effect of the radio environment. And because they never really had the literacy going, and once you get fully electrified and tribalized, you then try to balance it off by making everybody go to school and learn books. That's an early made literate society's effect. They are naive about literacy, but they think it kind of bounces off the radio. So they froze culture, McLuhan said, at 1850. So they maintained this 1850 position for, 70 years. That they didn't like Elvis, they banned everything.
That's right.
Any electronic cultures coming out of the West, they banned. And McLuhan, he didn't get mad at them. He didn't call them fascists. He just said they're stuck in the early print sensibility of 1850, they turned Victorian.
At the same time, Bob, they were developing space technology, and they sent crafts.
Right, but space technology is 19th century technology. That's point
but
of view.
Was,
you send so a rocket using, out to the moon.
Yeah, they were using technology in their
for 19th century goals.
But they were suppressing technology for their culture, for their society.
Well, they thought they would have fragmented departments. Said, we must keep up with the Americans on the paranoid military level, so we'll do the moon stuff on the military level. But they would not accept the real military actions, Madison Avenue and the pop culture that was happening in America. They said, no, none of that's allowed here. And you know what they used to say? They used to say America wasn't democratic. You know why? Because America would only show wealthy people who had done well in pop culture on the media. Whereas Russia said, we list the industrial output every day on our media. We say what the farmers grew, what the workers did in the steel plants. We show footage of the workers. They thought giving access to the workers as content in the media was democratic.
Interesting.
And Americans didn't do that. They favored, somebody being successful. One person, sold a million records. So they have a big story about him. That's not democratic. That's just isolating one fragmented bourgeois subject, highlighting it. So it's pretty interesting that their industrial boring stuff for us that they listed, they thought, well, no, this is democratic. We're listing what everybody did today.
Maybe we should do that.
We're sharing.
we're sharing what we're showing the community in action, whereas we show the individual in action, the literate private individual.
Interesting.
You've never heard this said before. It's very interesting stuff you can say when you know McLuhan. I mean, these words haven't been said before, what I'm saying.
Well, then you have to finish it out, Bob. We have to finish Russia out when Gorbachev visited during Reagan's presidency.
And what about it?
You said that he went to the supermarket and he expressed that they made a mistake, that they should have adopted some of the democratic business technologies because of the shortages of food that they had, that Russia had and all that.
You're saying Gorbachev said that the Russians made a mistake.
I heard it from you that Russia or Reagan invited Gorbachev to the United States and he came, and he was seeing American society, and he went to the supermarket. He saw the big warehouse food markets, you know.
Yeah.
In comparison to Russia, and the shortages of food and stuff they had, he remarked. And that's when he started reading McLuhan, or you said that he had...
No, he was already reading McLuhan. But what are you saying? He remarked, what did he say about when he saw this abundance of food?
That they should have implemented, that they should have advanced more technologically.
He embraced it.
It was a mistake to keep Russia suppressed. I don't remember saying that,
but that's okay. Yeah, so he's – no, I don't remember that at all. What I did say is that, you know, this woman I posted the other day who married an Eskimo, Galia?
Yes.
Did you see that post? She was the daughter of Gromyko's secretary, male secretary. You know, it was like first aid. And Gromyko was the foreign officer for many, many tyrants, you know, going back to Stalin. He was the most powerful guy for 40 years because he kept the same position while Khrushchev and them came and went, and Brezhnev and everybody. So Galia grew up right at the heart of the Soviet Union apparatus. She said they never could go on a vacation. Wherever Gromyko was, they went. And if Gromyko was on vacation, they went where he went because the aide always had – her father had to always be with this guy. So she told me that she got a hold of some McLuhan books, even though it was against the law to read McLuhan. That's what she said. And then I found out from the Evergreens that Gorbachev learned to go out in public and meet people one-on-one in the mid-80s. He learned it by reading McLuhan. And Gorbachev knew that people didn't believe regular Pravda information, that they believed samizdat, what's called samizdat, you know, privately published little leaflets and things, like an underground circuit of information. But he learned that if you go from McLuhan, he got the idea that if I go and talk to the people on the street corner and shake hands and interact with them, that'll be very effective. So I never heard Gorbachev say that. This is what the Evergreen said in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. But guess what? In about 1992, Corinne McLuhan got a personal letter from Gorbachev thanking her for all he'd learned from her husband.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. And so we're talking about Gorbachev got the interactive media down.
Maybe it was
from
the Evergreens
McLuhan.
Then. Maybe it was the Evergreens that you were talking about when you shared that statement.
Well, the Russians realized they could, once the computer economy came in by 81, 82, 83, they quickly realized they couldn't keep up. So they had to get American computer equipment. So they knocked the wall down to get computers. That's why the wall went down.
Wow.
Because they were getting poorer and poorer and falling behind based on their economic statistics, you know, whatever they were measuring.
Now, Bob, you said this woman contacted you recently, but you had met her.
Oh, yeah, Galia. Yeah, so what happened is that Carol and I met Galia in New York City around 2000. There was a whole Russian community that would come to our nonlinear salon or just after we stopped doing it. We stopped that in the spring of 2000. So summer 2000 leading into 2001, these interesting Russian people, I think Mark Stallman had met one of them. So we met a lot of Russians. So we met Galia, and she and her family came out to our place one Halloween on City Island. It would have been maybe the Halloween of 2000. And so her young kids could see a Halloween parade. So they came out to our place. So she was married to an American pilot because she had been a pilot. And she'd been a journalist also, but what happened was She never came out again, but our friend Bob Marshall came to New York in 2002, maybe even 2001, just before, because he had a girlfriend. He got a girlfriend in New Jersey, and normally he would come in to the Port Authority Transit subway station from New Jersey and get there about 9 in the morning. But for some reason, he didn't do that on 911, but he would have arrived there right when the buildings were collapsing or got hit right around 9 o'clock. So he befriended this woman in the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm. She wasn't a girlfriend or anything, but they talked a lot. And so that's the establishment law firm. It goes back to the Civil War. And the Dulles brothers and that were part of Sullivan and Cromwell. So he learned a lot about that law firm, which was pretty pretty exclusive, part of Big Brother, you'd say.
Yeah.
So, but anyways, his real name was Ed Pushar. He became a close friend of Galia, and so he did a lot of babysitting for Galia and all that because he lived near her down in Manhattan. So he saw more of her than we did, but we would hear about it from him and talk to Galia on the phone occasionally. Then we left, and Galia stayed in New York, and she says in that article that her kids went off to college, and suddenly she was by herself, and her husband was always flying and never around. So she decided to do something with her life. So she did a bunch of different things, got divorced from the husband, and ended up almost dying in the Arctic Circle with this other guy, this Eskimo journalist. And so for many weeks they were stranded, but they survived. And they were visiting, lost or out-of-the-way Eskimo settlements. They may not call them Eskimos anymore. She does, but in Canada you have to call them the Inuit people or something. Eskimo is a white man term. But I don't know if you Americans have that issue. I'm American too. I don't know if us Americans have that issue. You know about that? You don't use the word Eskimo?
Yeah, it's Inuit, yeah.
Okay. So she survived that, but she bonded with the guy and they got married. So we hadn't talked to her. Well, she had me on Mark Stallman had a party about 2010 and the Russians were there and they Skyped me in. And I was here in this place in Maui, so I had no shirt on. I was showing off my, slack lifestyle with no clothes. And so she took a picture of me. So that's somewhere on the internet, me standing there with just a short, or looks like I don't have any clothes on, but, it's from the short waist up. So that's the last time we talked to her, 2010. So here it is 7 years later, and out of the blue, I get a message on Facebook that she wants to interview Carolyn and spread the word in our stuff.
Oh,
our
wow.
Products. So that's going to happen in a couple of weeks when she gets her Skype set up. And
that's awesome.
I think she knows a lot of people around the world, so that'll be interesting. Even though she's stranded up in Eskimo land, that's where she lives.
Yeah,
she
does sound
super connected. She's dancing on ice.
What?
She's dancing on ice.
Oh, yeah, that's what she does. Yeah, her art project is to go around to visit the obscure settlements, the remote settlements, and dance on icebergs for them. So I saw – did you see the picture she sent? Oh, Carolyn fell asleep. It's not here, but – I don't know if I can post them, but incredible photographs taken of the icebergs and all that she does. And she occasionally slips and falls into the water, she said.
Oh, wow.
So Galia has come rushing back, and she talks about the maybe it was in what I posted. The people live long lives. They don't have any aches and pains. They work all day, play all day to survive. And they're in great shape.
The Inuit.
Yeah, the Inuits. They live real, like the grandmother, or maybe I guess her mother-in-law is 93 years old and works all day, plays, runs around, does everything, and has no ailments.
Hmm.
So that's the way people were, 1,000 years ago, say.
Yeah.
They weren't sedentary so much. Well, you could even say 100 years ago, maybe. But the sedentary ailments are what people are afflicted with today, plus everything else. So, well, if she gets them on our products, what will happen then?
They'll probably live to be 1,000.
Yeah. And they'll probably invade us. They'll take back Canada.
They'll become giants.
Yeah. Okay, so that was the first, let's see, nobody's muted out there, that thing. Don't know what it is, got a new internet connection, so the Turbo Bridge, which shows the phone calls coming in, it dies every couple minutes. Okay, so anybody have anything to say about what we read first, part one?
I mean, that's pretty intense. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
It's
pretty big.
It's,
big thought.
It's big. It's a big thought. It's a big thought.
So,
but I think it's good to think a big thought.
Yeah.
Opens up a lot.
Yeah, Bucky Fuller used to tell people, you know, you got to think bigger, think big. And McLuhan did it. McLuhan was showing how to do it. So, yeah, people would argue whether humans had ESP. McLuhan said electronics is ESP.
Mm.
Electronic environment is. Okay, so that's the way you could look at the millennials and younger. They are accused of being socially inept, can't talk. Well, they live in ESP all day long. Rapid.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, whatever that sound I was making, that Bush would, that Trump was. They're click, click, click. Okay, so. Oh, is that what I did?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was, I read the purpose. Now we read the hypotheses in this proposal. One, individuals, groups, etc., have a characteristic sensory typology, i.e. a particular sensory pathway which they prefer to use to the relative exclusion of other senses. This determines the way they perceive their world. For example, they see, Westerners see is in quotes, they see an idea, hear an idea, or feel it in the guts. For example, they see an idea, hear an idea, or feel it in the guts, those different sensory ways of talking about it. The rest of the senses...
So he's saying this about an individual or a collective group?
Both.
Okay.
He oscillates between, like he says here, individuals, comma, groups, right? Both levels, big, small, micro, macro. He oscillates back and forth. The rest, and so... People get into saying, oh, well, I read a book. No, I read out loud. And they'll talk about their particular sensory, eccentric way of engaging a book. So they say, well, I don't do that, so McLuhan's wrong. I don't do what McLuhan says, so McLuhan's wrong. They don't know he's also talking sociologically,
mm-hmm.
anthropologically, collectively, and what
right.
happens to a society that gets the visual bias over time. So you have to know he's working on both levels, more on the collective level than individual senses. Like he himself, he says, yeah, books are visual, but I find them tactile. He even said he didn't even find them personally a visual phenomenon. But he was trained to look at books as tactile from Finnegan's Wake. So much directions you can take the interpretation of what McLuhan's doing. So he says, for example, they see an idea, hear an idea, or feel it in the guts. The rest of the senses, the other seven, look at that, he says we have 10 senses. The rest of the senses, the other seven, which do not lead, order themselves in a preferred sequence, which is characteristics of that individual, his social, cultural, and national group. All right? The rest of the senses, the other seven, which do not lead, the visual, and more like the head senses, the seeing and hearing, that's due to books. The rest of the senses, the other seven, which do not lead, so he's probably including proprioceptive autonomic systems as sensory. They order themselves in a preferred sequence, which is characteristics of which is characteristic of that individual and his social and cultural and national grouping, this group.
But he doesn't detail, does he not detail those senses at all?
He always talked in five senses in general, but then later in the 70s, he said he personally believed we only had four senses, and that tactility was not a sense. It was the interplay of the senses. So we had eye, ear, taste and smell were one, and kinetic movement. Mm-hmm. And they were integrated by tactility, but it was not a sense. We call the fifth sense touch, but he emphasized that touch is not kinetic pressure. It's the gap. And then Barry Nevin said we had about 14 senses. He never outlined them. And I've never seen any other number until this moment where he says seven. So, unfortunately, we didn't get that explained.
I've heard in the New Age world we have 360 to complete a full circle, like degrees.
Right. Yeah, but they don't look at media as extensions of the senses.
Right. It's an entirely different context.
It's limited to chemical body and probably a bit of astral body thrown in.
Yes. Yes. In that statement, Bob, I just want clarification. You said the rest of the senses, the other seven, which do not lead. Is that LEAD, lead?
Yeah, which means that we're visually or acoustically in the head, around the eyes. You know, written speech is silent speech, but it's still got speech aspects in it, even though you're using your eyes. That's the Western bias that leads our preference in perception.
So
the
like
others
taste,
are sidelined.
So using taste as an example, it...
Taste doesn't lead in the Western literate society.
Yeah,
smell
it's
doesn't
manager-
lead.
Ordered by eating. I mean, you have to put the food in your mouth. You have to perform an action or something as opposed to your visual or your hearing kind of takes over other parts of your...
Yeah, you don't...
Involved in your mind.
You don't have to put visual data into your eyeball.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so then... Point two under hypotheses. This sensory typology is acquired through the necessity of adapting to current technological changes. Thus, sound moving pictures, or non-silent cinema, and radio would make for an oral culture. The printed book and television make for a visual culture, with a strong element of touch introduced by television. So this is very simple McLuhan on a big level. You have to read his books, which were just starting to come out then, on the details of these sensory changes caused by technology. So this sensory typology is acquired. So the characteristics of a culture, its sensory preference or bias, is acquired through the necessity of adapting to current technological changes. Thus, sound moving pictures and radio would make for an oral culture. The printed book and television make for a visual culture with a strong element of touch introduced by television. Normally, McLuhan would say that TV was not a visual medium, but he's saying it here, but then he qualifies it by saying there's a factor of touch in the visual culture of television. That'd be tactile visual culture. So that's the hypotheses. So then you go to the next part. So nothing, no questions about that one?
How is television touch?
Electricity is basically a tactile extension. And touch is, for McLuhan, not a sense, it's the interplay of the sensory data. It's the thing that organizes the other senses into a coherent perception. Some people might say, well, that's what the mind does, or the brain, but he called it tactility. And so when you touch something and then let go, then touch, let go, you create beat and rhythm. All right? Touch, remove your hand. Touch, remove your hand. Touch. So that rhythmic part of tactility is important. And so Electricity, McLuhan says, is tactile, an extension of tactility, because you can't see it, can't hear it. We don't know what it is. It's in that non-sensory zone. Okay? So then when you start making different technologies, use electricity, you get movies. That's kinetic motion and visible and acoustic. And then you got radio, which is mainly acoustic, and then you as content. And then you got telephone, which is interactive acoustic. And then you get television, which has sight and sound and movement. And because your brain has to make the image, it the dots go into your perceptive apparatus. It's called light through, as opposed to light on, which light bounces off the printed page and goes into your eyes. That's light on. But light through is gets you in the guts, is what happens on television. So if you think of the interplay of so many senses in television at that time, it was the most multi-sensuous, so it's an extension of the interplay of tactility.
Yeah.
So Bob, that strong element of touch, the tactility, is different with the book than it is with the television, but it's both, it's still tactility.
And another thing is that when you're reading a book, it emphasizes the individual because you read alone and silently. Now, you watch TV, you're sharing the content with millions.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very different experience, way different from movies.
Well, you know, and I just notice that when you describe that, and I've heard that over and over, but that's a relationship with light, tactility.
Right. That's why light is the basic, one of the basic phenomena in Finnegan's Wake. And there's a scattered throughout Finnegan's Wake is the historical debate about what light is. It goes into Newton's theories, which were a big influence on artists and that in, I guess, the 1700s. Then it goes into another guy's Jung's, Y-O-U-N-G, his theories of light in the 19th century. And then it gets up to the quantum physicists and their idea of light. So light is not just a visual phenomenon. Light can be, I guess you'd say, tactile. So, and then Ion says we're made up of light and salt.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So there's an interaction with light.
Yeah. There's a making. Once you're a literate society, you receive light in the eyeball passively. But before literacy and after literacy, the eyeball broadcasts. The eyeball makes your perception. So McLuhan said when television came in and the making part of the eyeball was retrieved, people weren't comfortable with that. So they had to have sensory training, so they took LSD and drugs to experience the act of broadcasting eyeball. Basically, they start hallucinating.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
She just had a eureka. She went, ah.
Yeah. That's cool.
I'm still holding back my cum. I haven't come in your face yet. You can have all the orgasms you want, but I'm holding back.
Well, that's just suddenly that's a perfect representation of that interaction. The tactility is our interaction with light when you talk about the printed book and how it bounces back at you, but bounces off the page, and the television moves through you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I always think of that album cover. What's the album cover, Bob, with the, who's the band where the TV's blowing the guy back in the chair and his hair's blowing back?
That's like an ad for stereo systems?
No, I'm pretty sure it's an album cover of a rock band.
I don't know that. I've seen that image in ads, but I don't know if I know that album.
Yeah, I don't remember the band.
So
that is why in the five bodies you talk about the television living inside of a person.
Yeah.
Their TV body, because that is that interaction with the light.
Yeah, there's no
it becomes
there's no boundary.
The person. Yeah.
There's not a huge boundary when, as you do with light on, light bouncing. You can't
right.
even tell who's where the light's coming from. It's just
mm-hmm.
tattooing you, McLuhan used to say.
Mm-hmm.
That's why tattoos got accepted in the long run. They're already being tattooed with the pixels and the TV light experience.
Tattoos
have become very common. It's
yeah.
completely like the norm.
Yeah. And you see everybody. I see it on the beaches all day long. Everybody has a token something. I think
mm-hmm.
they even have things you can paste on.
Oh.
You know. Yeah, Nick.
Did the LSD change the eyeball into the inner television? Because I thought LSD affected the brain.
Well, it does that too. It confuses the whole sensory. I have everyone's talking about it. It just confuses your sensory signaling system. So it activates the whole process. So it goes deep. It goes on the surface. But it is an art form. You're getting activated and you don't know it when you're watching television. But you eventually find out about LSD and you want to take it, or it became a fad. You unconsciously or subliminally know that this will retrieve what's actually happening when I watch TV. This will activate consciously my eye broadcasting and making up
within
content.
Mm-hmm. Hallucinating.
Phenomenal. Yeah.
And I think there was
and yet the TV is constantly broadcasting and is therefore creating our TV body, or we are one with the TV in that broadcast.
Yeah, the TV environment, what I call the landscape.
TV
it doesn't
environment,
become a body
yes, sorry, the
until
landscape.
Digital technology
yes.
takes over and makes TV the content of your cell phone. You know, that's where
yes,
it gets shrunk to a body level. But it's a landscape, a new environment swallowing the whole universe in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Mm. And the cell phone does the same thing now as the
swallowed
TV.
It.
Mm.
No, a cell phone is not TV. TV is one subset. The cell phone is the internet play of the bodies, of the post-landscapes.
Yes. Post-landscapes.